You ever get the feeling everyone's looking at you? Thank you, Larry. My name is Ross, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm sober here today by the grace of God and this life-changing, life-saving miracle that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. It's really an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything in AA. But I got to tell you, it's a real treat to be here in Kansas with y'all this weekend. And I just want to say thank you to Gloria and Joanne and Larry and Carol and Carol in the blue coat from the airport. And everybody's just been real nice, and it's just a treat to be here. I don't, getting up in the morning and flying halfway across the country to tell my story isn't something I do very often. But it's really a treat, and it's just real good to be here. One thing I want to take just a minute on before I start my little story, particularly if there's any of the newer people in the room, and that's to remind us all that I don't speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. In a gathering of qualified people, I'm just one sober drunk. For some reason, tonight it's my turn to share experience, strength, and hope, in keeping with our primary purpose to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Nothing I say will add one iota to the body of knowledge that's already available to us about this problem we call alcoholism. Nothing I say will add one dot or one tittle to the body of knowledge that's already available to us about the solution for this problem. My story isn't unique. It's not universal. What I am is an alcoholic. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a witness to the suggested program of recovery outlined in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, works for a hopeless, helpless drunk like me. And the testimony I'm going to give is simply how AA has worked for me since June 25th, 1979, for which I'll be eternally grateful. What I'm going to try to do with the language of the heart is share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened to me, and what my life is like today. My little story begins in the middle of July in Lexington, Kentucky. I was the first of three children to a working-class family. My memory's a little fuzzy, but I'm told it was a happy occasion for all, you know. These are the same people that lied to me about Santa Claus. But, I'll have to take their word for it, you know. But, I wasn't keeping a diary then. But within a matter of days, a few hundred miles away, in Akron, Ohio, an ailing physician was helped from his sickbed, made as comfortable as possible in the back seat of a car for the ride to Cleveland, where Alcoholics Anonymous the month before had celebrated its 15th anniversary, an anniversary it shared with that ailing physician. And at this conference, Dr. Bob S., our co-founder, gave his last public address. He said in part, after thanking the God of his understanding that he could have been some small part of something that meant so much to so many, he asked us to keep this thing simple. He said, let's don't mess up Alcoholics Anonymous with things of interest to the scientific mind. Dr. Bob suggested that Alcoholics Anonymous boils down to love and service. In rooms like this, in church basements and clubhouses all over this country, our old-timers are sitting in the corner, the bleeding deacons, they're begging us to keep this thing simple. Alcoholics Anonymous is about love and service. I don't know why, but my earliest idea was that life was easier for other people. Somehow I knew that. That's the oldest idea I can remember, that life was easier for other people. I had a sense that I probably ought to keep that to myself. You just don't start a conversation with, I know life is easier for you. No, what you do is you bluff. That's what I did, I bluffed. But I was a scared kid. I don't really know why. All of my basic needs were met. I know that because I'm here. And if they hadn't be, I wouldn't. But I just had a sense that life was easier for other people. It got easier for me, though. I was 14 years old. I was a new kid in school. I'd moved from Augusta, Georgia to Rockville, Maryland, and I had a big day. I went to school every day with two cigarettes, one Marlboro, one Pall Mall. I'd steal one from my mom and one from my dad. That way they'd never notice, you know. So I was having my before-school cigarette. I'd alternate between the Marlboro and the Pall Mall, you know. Before-school cigarette. And two guys asked me a big question. They said, "Ross, you want to skip school?" I'd never really done anything that exciting before, you know. But I said, sure, let's skip school, you know. So I had an adventure. I skipped school with these two twin brothers, and we went over to their house. And obviously by this time I'd also smoked my other cigarette, so it was a long day. But we went over to their house, and both their parents worked. So it may have been my first time without adult supervision, I'm not sure, but... So we went over there, and one of them asked me a question. He says, "Ross, you ever done any drinking?" Well, I'd never really done any drinking, but I didn't think I ought to tell him that, you know. I said, "Sure, I've done drinking. I was going to ask you if you ever did any drinking, you know." He said, "Well, we're going to have a little drink here, you know." And they made him a drink, and they had a glass. I don't even know what they drank, but they asked me what I drank. I said, "Well, I drink bourbon." I knew that because I was from Kentucky. And it started to come to me. I knew I didn't need one of those glasses. And I wasn't going to mix it up with anything else. I knew I drank bourbon. I knew I drank it straight. And I was in the mood, you know. So I told you it was a big day, right? So I drank socially with these two guys for 6 or 8 minutes. And that's about how long it took, man, I got to tell you. Something happened. I wasn't scared anymore. I wasn't confused. As a matter of fact, I was wondering what had confused me, you know. I was starting to get a glow inside, and I was feeling strong and tall. I was pretty sure I could dance, you know. I didn't want to dance with them, but I was sure I could dance, you know. And I was thinking about some other things, too, but so I had me a bottle of bourbon, and these guys had a couple of drinks, and I don't think we'll ever meet them here because they fell asleep on the floor. And I just don't think that gets you to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I got to tell you, I wasn't in the mood for a nap. So I was kind of feeling like adventure. So I took my bottle of bourbon, and I couldn't go home. My mom was there, you know, so the only other place I knew to go was back to school. So if you skip school, you don't have to go to class, you know. So I hid my little bottle of bourbon in the bushes, and every once in a while I'd go out and give me a little nip. And I'd just kind of wander the halls, and I don't know about in Kansas, but in Maryland, if you're a new kid in school, they assign like an 11th or 12th grader to you. And his job every day is to hit you. And dare you to say anything, you know. Just dare you. You hit me back, I'll really hurt you, you know. Well, this guy had been assigned to me, you know, and his job every day was to hit me. I knew that because he hit me every day. And I saw this guy. He was in the hall, and I was in the hall. I just kind of went in the boys' room there and waited for him, because I knew what he had to do. He had to hit me. And I waited for him, and I just stood there. I didn't say a word, and he walked up to me, and he hit me. I knew that was going to happen, but something was different. I went ahead and shared my feelings with the fellow. And I tell you, I felt like Superman, you know. My arms got tired. I didn't want to share my feelings anymore, you know. So I shared my feelings with the fellow, and go back out, give me another little nip, and I'm wandering the halls, and there's this little girl that I've been flirting with, and, well, we were smiling at each other. I guess that's flirting. But a lot of people smiled at me since I've been here. So I asked her if I could carry her books home and walk home with her after school, and she said, I don't remember whether she said okay or I couldn't wait for you to ask. one or the other. But so I walk her home, and the truth is I got my first real kiss. And I knew it was a real kiss because I could feel it in my toes. And when my aunt kissed me, I couldn't feel it in my toes. You know? There was something different about this, you know. And I got to tell you, alcohol worked for me. Whiskey opened a door and let me step out smooth into a life that had scared me. It worked for me. By the time I was 15 years old, I found a place to sell me beer. By the time I was 16 years old, I found a bar where I could get drinks. By the time I was 17 years old, I had a bottle in my locker. I barely graduated from high school. And the truth is, I was in trouble with alcohol. I lost my first job when I was 17 years old for drinking on the job. A little place that I'd worked for a couple of years while I was going to school. I'd work full-time in the summer and part-time during the school year, and they really liked me there. They'd been good to me, and I'd worked hard for them. But they had to let me go because I was drunk on the job. I didn't know it at the time, but it was to be the longest employment I would have until I found you people here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had entry-level positions in all professions. I tried everything for 6 months, except doctor and lawyer. And I did do a little amateur pharmaceutical work, if you know. You know what I mean? We won't go any further. Best left to the professionals or something like that. But every once in a while somebody would say, you know, Ross, it might be the drinking. And I'd think to myself, it can't be the drinking. These people can't understand. Surely it's the drinking that's allowing me to have a life. Drinking's not my problem. Drinking's my answer. 14 times I ran my car into something that wouldn't move no matter how hard I hit it. And I was bad for, well, I'll tell you, I had some very strongly held political beliefs. I thought that if you owned more than would fit in your car, you had gotten materialistic. And I was not materialistic, let me put it that way. I like to move at night. I don't know why. Just seems like you get a fresher start that way. I like to load up my stuff, and you know, at night, if you're asleep, I could take some of your stuff, you know. And, by then, nobody understood me, you know, so I had to move on, and so I moved a lot. You know, you're in trouble if you wake up in the back of your truck in a 7-Eleven parking lot, and you got to buy a newspaper to find out where you are. That's a clue. But every once in a while somebody'd say, you know, Ross, if you loved me, you wouldn't drink like that. I mean, that made sense to me. I've had bosses tell me, you know, if you had any respect for your job here, you wouldn't drink on the job. That made sense to me. I had people tell me that if you had any respect for yourself, you wouldn't drink like that. That made sense to me. People who didn't understand this problem were explaining it to me. But you know what? It made sense. It made sense. In the end, what had opened doors and allowed me to step out smooth was closing in on me. But I couldn't really see that, and it didn't really matter. Because the truth is, I couldn't face my life without a drink. I can remember seeing people do simple things, washing their car, playing with their kids, and knowing that I would never know that experience. Seeing a family in the yard playing hurt, because I just knew that that would never be part of my experience. I got to the point where I couldn't check my mail regular. I couldn't always answer the door or answer the phone. If someone was to knock, I'd peek through a little hole and hope they couldn't hear me breathing. And then run and hide. In the end, it was like I lived in a chilly vapor. And there was a frostiness inside that just wouldn't go out. Towards the end, I could drink the whiskey around the clock and the fear wouldn't go away. What had worked wasn't working anymore. I was bad for drinking and driving. I was bad for drinking and playing with guns. 100 bar fights, a dozen episodes with knives and guns. It's like I try to stay away. I try to stay home. I tell myself, well, this time I won't drink and drive, you know. And then I'd say, well, maybe I'll drive, but I won't take the guns, you know. I was always drawing a line in the sand, and I was always crossing it. I remember the last holiday that my family invited me to was Thanksgiving. I got there in January. And if I recall, I was a little put out that there wasn't any turkey and dressing for me. But it was a long trip. I lived about 3 or 4 miles away. And there were many stops, and it seems I got there in January. But it used to be hard to get a DWI. But back in the 70s, I finally got one. And the way I did this was I had been driving a cab, and I had a disagreement with the cab company. I was renting a cab from there. I thought it only made sense to live there, too, you know. And they had kind of thought it was for working and not for living, you know. And so we parted company, and I'd gotten a job driving this little van. And one night I drove it into 3 parked cars in front of a police station. And nobody had to call them. They just kind of heard the ruckus and come on out, you know. Some guy who saw the whole thing said that I had been, that there were no headlights on, but the inside light was on, and he said his head was laying down on the steering wheel. He was grinning from ear to ear, and he just ran into 3 parked cars. You know? If anyone's curious about policemen, I want you to know they have feelings too. I know, because I shared my feelings with them, and they shared their feelings with me, and we did the mystery dance, I got to tell you. But come to find out, you can get charged with drinking and driving. I used to get I get pulled over, and they tell me to, well, drink coffee here or wait here, and I'm going to check on you, you know. But this time they arrested me for driving and drinking, and I got myself a public defender, and I told him I wanted to plead not guilty. And he told me about the guy that watched the whole thing, and then I was thinking, well, maybe temporary insanity, you know. I ended up going to a DWI school, which is where I thought you might learn to drink and drive a little better, you know. And after 14 accidents, I wasn't doing that good at it, you know. And, I could use a couple tips, and they were there to help me, I was sure. And so they made us watch some films and stuff, and at the end they had this little exit interview, I guess, or evaluation, and this counselor was sitting there asking me a bunch of questions, and they asked me if I ever thought about going to AA. I said, no, I never thought about that. What's AA? They said, Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, no, that won't be necessary. And they explained to me that they were going to write this report, and the judge was going to consider that when he made a decision as to whether or not I'd get to keep my driver's license. And I told this counselor I thought I'd like to go to an AA meeting. I was going to ask you about AA, you know. Yeah. So I promised this counselor that I would go to this AA meeting and that I wouldn't drink before I went. And I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were there. Surprise, surprise. And I don't remember a lot about the meeting, but there was a bunch of people sitting around a circle. I could tell a couple of things. It looked like you were not drinking on purpose. You know, it just like wasn't like you forgot or something, you know. And everyone in there wasn't broke, you know. So I picked up this sense of intent, you know, that these people were not drinking on purpose. And I had a sense of them being comfortable with themselves. And I was thinking that when I didn't drink, I didn't feel the way y'all look, you know. Because when I didn't drink, I got twitchy and stuff, you know. I used to have my calling was happy people. I was the kind of drunk that would cross the street to share his feelings with happy people, you know. I figured they were shallow. And if I could fill them in, you know, then surely they could see the world the way I saw it. But these people are sitting there. They're not drinking on purpose. And they're comfortable with themselves. So I knew I was different. But I couldn't get out of there without promising to come back next week. And The way they did that, I don't know about around here, but they get some big guy to stand in front of the door, and somebody else shakes your hand, and you won't let go. And they gave me a little membership card, you know, that little, got the preamble and the steps and the tradition. And I'm sticking this in my pocket and stuff, and this guy still won't let go of my hand. He makes me promise to come back next week, you know. I figured, yeah, I could do that, you know. But I wasn't going to make the same mistake I made the first time. I wasn't going sober. I had sat through this meeting sober once, and I got to tell you, it was a little intense. But so I figured with a couple of bracers, y'all would be a little easier to take, you know. So I got myself about half a belly full, and in my case, that's a good start. But I went to this AA meeting, and it was about the same. And it seems like these people had a meeting after the meeting. You know, they went and drank coffee at this pancake house up there in Rockville, and same thing happened. This guy's shaking my hand. He won't let go, and they're going for coffee. Why don't you come? And I'm trying to get out of there, but okay. I mean, nice people. But I don't know how the new guy gets, like, the middle chair or something. I'm in this coffee shop, you know. I've got, like, the inside seat, you know. I don't know. These are very funny people, but so I'm sitting there and the drink's wearing off, you know, and I'm starting to get thirsty, and these people are very nice, you know. I'm going, well, you know, how am I going to do this, you know what I mean? So I figured, I don't know where this came from, but I figured I'd be honest with them. I just tell them the truth, you know, and surely then everyone would move and I could get out of there. And I just leaned to this person sitting next to me and said, I got to tell you the truth, I've been drinking. Some very funny people. He said, yes, Ross, we know. I wasn't used to that. I'm used to people pointing at me and yelling at me, doing that kind of stuff. But I got to tell you, their stock went way up when they told me they did understand. And I got out of there, and I got out to the car, and I got that drink I needed. And I never really wanted to see Alcoholics Anonymous again. The only problem is that it didn't work anymore. You see, I could drink the whiskey around the clock, and that fear was still in my chest. That vapor I lived in, nothing would put out the chill. So I tried AA one year, and the man that's my sponsor today led every meeting I went to, both of them. And I'd heard his story at the first meeting, and these were speaker meetings. I went about 6 months apart. And if anyone's thinking of trying that approach, let me just tell you, it didn't work for me. But the second time, I recognized the story, and I didn't put a dollar in that basket, you know. I figured this guy was president of AA, and he probably got to keep the money, and I wasn't paying twice for the same story, you know. And if I knew that later he would be my sponsor, I'd have put the dollar in the second. he's a character. He's a character. I tried to stay away, but my life just didn't work. I was coming off a drunk one time. The best I can remember, I'd been drinking around the clock for about 3 days, and I was in the woods behind this little shopping center, not far from where I was living, and I kind of came out of a blackout or a grayout sitting on this bench, and I remember checking to see if I had any money, because I was thirsty. Every cell in my body wanted a drink, and I had money in my pocket. And I got up off the bench and started headed towards the package store, about four doors down this little shopping center, and a little sense came over me. It was like, not right now, Ross. And I got to tell you, I had money in my pocket, and I wanted to drink with every cell in my body. I was thirsty. But for some reason, I just had that sense, and I went on past the liquor store, and I just kept walking. I went to the end of the shopping center, and I went in the movies. I didn't care what was playing. I just wanted to be in the dark. I wanted to hide. And I was shaking, and I was baking, and I was thirsty, and I wanted a drink, and I had money in my pocket. I was afraid they'd be closed when that movie was over. I was afraid they wouldn't be closed. I stayed in there as long as I could in the dark, and I got out of there, and I went headed back down towards the liquor store, and they were still open. And that sense came back over me again, maybe not right now, Ross, and I was thirsty, but it was just a sense of maybe not right now. And I walked past that liquor store again, and I went back down by where the bench was, and there was a payphone there, and I called the cab company. And I asked them to get a cab, and they said, we're real busy right now. We don't have any cabs in the area. Call us back in 30 minutes. And I thought, great, I can get me a taste, because, you know, that's what I need. I need a drink. And I was hurting every place you can hurt and thirsty. I had money in my pocket, and I headed back towards that liquor store, and there was a taxi cab sitting at the curb. And I got in that taxi cab. Later, I closed the door. But I was sitting in the back seat of that car looking at that liquor store. What I needed was in a bottle on the shelf in there. And this guy says, where are you going? I said, anywhere. Just get me out of here, man. He said, we usually work with more information, you know. And I told him where I live, this little rat-infested place I had, and he's heading that way, and I'm thirsty, and I'm thinking, well, maybe there's this other place, and we'll stop and get a bottle, because I needed a drink. And up on the dashboard, stuck in the air vent, was a little white card with a Serenity Prayer on it. And I asked that man what he knew about the program where that card came from. He said he was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why did I ask? I told him I might have a problem with drinking. I thought he could have smelled that, you know. All of his passengers didn't have sticks in their hair, you know. Leaves and stuff, you know. Smelled like he'd been drinking for 3 days, you know. But the cab driver took me home and came upstairs. He brought a book. He read to me from the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't tell me what was wrong with my life. He didn't tell me what I had to do. He didn't tell me what I better do. He didn't tell me where I was going if I didn't do it. He talked about himself. He told me about his drinking, what had happened to him, and what his life was like now. I never met a man like that before in my life. At some point, he asked if he could use the phone, and I was so happy it was turned on, you know. That's a good question. Call anywhere, man. And just kind of called his wife and told her he was going to be late for dinner. If I live to be 100, I'll never forget what it feels like to know that your life is not worth a good man being late for dinner. And I tried to stop him, and he said, Ross, I'm not doing this for you. You may not understand this, but I'm doing this for me. This helps me stay sober. And I didn't understand. I didn't understand it then, but I do tonight. Within a few hours, I was in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because I wanted to be there. I didn't really think it would work for me, but I wanted to meet some more people like him. I had never in my life met a man like that. And I did. I met you wonderful people. The most exciting, wonderful, giving people I ever met in my life. I wanted to be like you. I wanted to be like you. And I kept getting drunk. 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month. For years, I grew to hate you. I grew to hate you because Alcoholics Anonymous was working for you and it didn't work for me. Our literature talks about being at the jumping off place. I was an hour and a half away from killing a halfway decent fella. And something happened. There was a guy who had been my sponsor. He used to say, Ross, why don't you call me before you drink? I'd say, Buck, I just never think of you before I drink. I always thought of Buck after I drank. Because I'd go on a toot and Buck would let me sleep off on his couch. He'd give me a cigarette and make me chicken soup. He was a good man. He had tried. He had given of himself. But I knew it wasn't going to work. I was going to kill myself. I didn't want any lectures. I was jumping off out a window on the ninth floor. I figured that way I wouldn't have to listen to anybody tell me why I did that. But just to say goodbye to Buck, I stopped at his little AA club. He'd been a good man. He had tried. I didn't tell him what I was going to do. I just stopped to say hi, have a cup of coffee. And he did something he'd never done before. He went ahead and locked up the club and asked me to stay and talk to him. And I didn't have anything important. And this guy asked me if I would try treatment. And I just didn't want to break his heart, you know. I knew that I was too sick for Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew it wouldn't work. But I didn't want to break the old guy's heart, so I said, sure, Buck, I'll try it. I ended up in the Institute for the Very Nervous. And that's where I should have been, I got to tell you. There were some design flaws. There was no doorknob on my side, you know. I asked for the 800 number. I had some ideas I wanted to call in. They said, you're not ready for that, you know. But I don't know whether I was on homicide watch or suicide watch, but they had me in a room by myself for a while. And the guy who ran the place came to talk to me. I said, I don't think that you can help me here. I've tried Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm obviously too sick for AA. And this man said to me, he said, you know, Ross, I believe that you've been to some meetings, but I don't think you've ever tried the suggested program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, besides, I don't think you're too sick for AA. You've just never felt the love in the rooms. My whole world got silent because the truth is I had never felt the love anywhere. It had never been enough. If I'd been raised by Mother Teresa, I'd have been a neglected child. It just wasn't enough, you know what I mean? More for me, mostly, you know? More for me. A man came on the unit and led an AA meeting. He said something that changed my life. He said that the victory over alcoholism has already been won. That the miracle happened in 1935 was shared with the world in a book in 1939. And my decision was simply whether or not I wanted to take part in a miracle that already happened. I had thought this was some kind of philosophy club or something. You know, and I would go home at night and I'd try to get me a philosophy because I wanted to show off like y'all do, you know. Well, at least that's what I thought you were doing, you know. Maybe some of you are, I don't know. I was incapable of developing a philosophy of living life sober. And he told me that the victory had already been won. By this time, I was in a room with three other men, and I did something I was so ashamed of, I hid in the bathroom. And I closed the door, and I found myself on my knees. I found myself begging a God I had no understanding of to let me be like you people. Please, just let me be like those people. Something happened. Something happened. As a result of that treatment, I met some men and women who had experienced the solution to this problem. I opened the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It had been read to me, but I had never really read it. I started with the doctor's opinion, and I found out I was wrong. I was wrong about alcoholism. I was wrong about me. I was wrong about you. I was wrong about God. Other than that, I had it pretty well figured out. Short list, you know. But when Dr. Silkworth talks about the alcoholic getting to the point where he can no longer delineate the true from the false, I knew it was right. Because I had never gone in a liquor store saying, please, could I get another bottle of that stuff that almost killed me yesterday? Yeah, I wrecked the car, got fired, the old lady won't talk to me. I think I need another bottle, you know? No, it's not what I thought. My mind told me, just a taste, Ross, and you can step out smooth. Yeah, it's hard to step out smooth when everything you own is in a locker at the Greyhound bus station, you know? If you're selling your blood to buy Wild Irish Rose, there's no smooth. But my mind's telling me, forget about the cardboard box, man. Get a taste. You'll be good, man. No, my mind was lying to me. I could not delineate the true from the false. It seems our problem lies in our mind. A physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession. If I was allergic to strawberries, you think I'd be out looking for an all-night store to get some more? You think it'd be strawberry bootleggers? No. Because if I got sick eating strawberries, I wouldn't eat them no more. I went to public school, but I could do that, you know? No, a mental obsession led me to the first drink. I understood for the first time in my life that the problem was hiding behind my eyes. My mind was trying to kill me. It must think that it can kill me and go on living. I don't know. But I met the men and women in this program that understood the problem, had experienced the solution, and were familiar with a proven action program to get that solution. And I got sober. I got sober the way you got sober. I got sober with the steps. I had a realization. I had thought the first step meant I couldn't drink safely. But come to find out, I knew that before I met you. I didn't need Alcoholics Anonymous to explain to me, if you've set yourself on fire a couple times, wrecked your car 14 times, you keep getting in bar fights and gun fights, that this could lead to a bloody end, you know? I didn't need you to teach me that I couldn't drink safely. I needed you to teach me that I couldn't not drink. I'm powerless over alcohol in the bottle, on the shelf, in the store. I don't have a defense against that mental obsession. One thought dominating all other thoughts. Consequences out the window. Fixation on something that happened when I was 14 years old. I just wanted to be Superman one more time. But it wasn't real for me anymore. That effervescence, that wonderful I'm okay, you're okay feeling just wasn't there anymore for me. I had another experience with a man that was still yet to become my sponsor. He gave me a ride home one night from a meeting that we were, I spent the first 18 months of my sobriety in a halfway house. And Mike had given me a ride home from this meeting, and I had a big question. I've been practicing for a couple of days, you know, trying to get up the courage to ask him. And tonight was the night, and I just popped the question. I said, Mike, do you think I could ever have a regular life? He said, Ross, what do you mean, a regular life? I said, you know, a library card? Be a registered voter? Maybe get a telephone in my own name? It'd really be something to get your mail the same place you slept, you know? That'd be moving up the food chain, you know? He said, yes, Ross, I think you can have a regular life. I went to bed with new hope. A guy like me could have a regular life. After I was in the house for a few months, one of the guys I lived with had a six-month anniversary. We all went to the meeting, and he got a six-month chip. And I remember feeling good for him, being happy for another human being. And that night, I went to bed with a new piece of information about myself, that I could care for another drunk. We talk about a hole inside. I'm not sure if that hole was something I wasn't getting. I'm absolutely certain it was something I wasn't given. You're the easiest people in the world for me to love. You remind me of myself. You were the first people whose love I really experienced. Maybe it's because you understood me like no one else has ever understood me. If you're new here, my guess is that you haven't had a very good year. You know? 8,000 AA meetings, and that's what I come up with. You haven't had a very good year. Maybe you don't feel the love that's in this room right now. I didn't feel it for a while. But I started being able to recognize those who could. They've got a sparkle in their eye. And I sat next to them. I sat next to them. And one day I felt it. One day I felt this healing love that's in this room. My life has never been the same. Something happened. As a result of narrow-minded sponsorship, you know, the black part, not the white part, Ross, you know. You already knew how to read between the lines when you got here, you know. Get a dictionary, you know. The words mean what it meant to them, not what it means to you. So my dictionary is a 1939 dictionary. I made a decision. I was sitting on the edge of my bed at this halfway house, and this man that was sponsoring me sat with me and asked me if I believed that anything other than God could solve my problem. I told him no, I didn't think so. And he knelt on the floor and waited for me. What seemed like 100 years, I knelt with him and said that third step prayer. I made a decision. I said I made a decision. I found out in the fourth and fifth step that I had never known the dignity of a free choice. Fear had run my life. If I was to know the dignity of a free choice, it would be the grace of God. One day I experienced God's love. I just knew. I just knew there was a God and that he loved Ross. And that he loved you. And that we were all where we were supposed to be to get where we were going. My life has never been the same. Just never been the same. In the sixth step, I became entirely ready to have God remove everything that was killing me because it didn't work. When I asked myself, what's in it for me? I was just believing a lie. Just believing a lie. I got to tell you, literature suggests that giving rather than getting will become the guiding principle. And that has happened for me too. That has happened for me too. If you've never known the experience of seeing hope in someone's eyes the hour they first believed that AA could work for them too, you can't miss that. You can't miss that. I got here with every pain, wound, and hurt that I've ever experienced in my life. But I've seen them be healed. I've seen my pain be redeemed. When what I was ashamed of becomes a bridge for someone to take that first step from isolation to unity, it was worth it. It was worth it. It doesn't hurt anymore. I'd do it again. I'd do it again to experience what I thought I would never experience. Usefulness. Usefulness. 100 men and women, what if they knew what they were talking about? What if they meant exactly what they said? Line by line, paragraph by paragraph, I've seen men in and out of this program for 30 years get sober. I've seen men in and out of this program for 27 years get sober, line by line, paragraph by paragraph. What if they meant exactly what they said? If you're new, I want to share something with you that the first 100 shared with me and with all of us. They ask that we cling to an idea that in God's hands, our dark past will become our greatest asset. With it, we'll avert death and misery for other people. And we too will experience usefulness. I don't know why you loved me, but you did. I love you, God bless you.